You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Well, hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, senior editor.
A Deep Tran associate editor.
And we are here on our first post-election podcast. We're not going to talk too much about that, but we will be talking a little bit about that.
There's a world before and a world...
There's a world before 11-9 and a world after 11-9. So we'll also speak about the latest developments in the fair wage on stage, the equity and off-Broadway theaters negotiations, which are going on and which are scheduled to come to a close this Sunday, the 20th.
Yep.
They were extended for 2 weeks. Then we'll talk a little bit about what we think artists and theaters can do, should do, should be thinking of in response to our current moment. We are called American Theater, after all. Then we have an interview, we're very happy about this, with Sarah Dillap, the playwright behind The Wolves, a play that we've all recommended here, a play about a girls' soccer team. Where's it set exactly? It's in New England or?
No, it's in the
middle. It's in Ohio or something.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Ohio.
In the middle of America.
It's not really a specified town, though.
That's right.
I thought it was Utah.
No, I think it's more like Ohio.
I should read the script again.
In any case, it was her first play, right?
Yeah.
She's the winner of the Relentless Award, the award named after, created when Phil Hoffman died. And she's in Juilliard right now. Is that correct?
No, she's at Brooklyn College right now.
Oh, gosh. I get this all mixed up.
Yeah, and all those New York
I knew that
MFA
she was one of the Mac Wellman students.
Yes.
So there's a number of folks getting produced now who are still in programs, and she's one of them, but at Brooklyn College.
And,
anyway.
Scott Rudin is producing The Wolves and putting it up again.
Off-Broadway
at the Duke, yes.
At the Duke, yeah. Well, if you haven't seen it and you're in New York, anywhere near New York, go see it. Wonderful play. Yeah, or produce it in your neighborhood.
Well, it might not be out yet because Scott Rudin has
Right, but after it's only up until December. So
sure.
More young women need parts. So put this play and employ a lot of women. It's gonna be awesome.
So we'll get to hear a little bit about Sarah and then we'll come back with recommendations. So let's kick it off with the latest in the off-Broadway negotiations. What happened this week that's new?
Nothing really besides the delaying it for a week.
Right.
But Helen Shaw, a frequent contributor at American Theater, came out with this really great piece in The Guardian about the kind of conversations that are happening within the room.
Mm-hmm.
And also, unlike the other pieces, like there are some really stark numbers within her piece. Mm. That it's surprising,
mm-hmm.
and
well, yeah, it's a surprise. I mean, actors make with the minimum is $5.93, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that for off Broadway theaters of small size? And they're asking for a raise to $8.10 as the minimum.
Yeah.
What shocked me about Helen's piece was that it said a lot of theaters outside of New York add 10% for the agent's fee, but mm-hmm. theaters in New York don't do that.
Yeah. And by the way, that's weekly, so we should be clear. $5.93 a week.
Weekly.
They want to raise it to $8.10 a week. Well, we've talked last time about how there does seem to be a difference between Lort Theaters
right.
and the Lort contract and the off-Broadway contract.
Oh, yes. I should really correct myself. I believe last time I said that Lort Theater contracts is governed by seat size. That is not true. It's governed by box office revenue.
Okay.
So if you make a lot, then you should pay more to your actors, which seems like a more equitable way than a very arbitrary, 100-seat, 300-seat seating arrangement.
But the off-Broadway contracts are all based around seats. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we speculated, sort of not knowing what we were talking about, that seemed like a silly thing. And it is kind of a silly, antiquated thing. I mean, it makes sense for as a way to measure when you're doing a commercial production. Like seat size does correlate maybe to income, to volume. But I don't know, in the nonprofit, it's kind of a weird, arbitrary way to do it. Especially, as we said, Signature, where the tickets are subsidized anyway.
And because in the Guardian piece, there was one part about the public theater particularly when they put up Gats. And one of the actors said, we got paid more on tour than we did doing it at the Public, and we got paid $5.39 a week there because they had it.
$5.93.
$5.39 at that point in 2012.
Oh,
now
I see.
It's $5.93.
Okay, it's raised for cost of
$56. But yeah, but that was in the Public's smaller space, but the Public has different spaces and they're all different seating configurations.
Yeah.
So it seems really unfair if you're an actor and you're unlucky enough to work in the Public smaller space, you'll be paid less than someone working in their larger space.
That
was all going to the same pot in the end.
That elevator repair service story was a striking one. And there were a lot of little anecdotes in there about, I don't think it was that one. It was another one where someone said, can't you pay me more? And the producer says, when are you going to pay me more? And he says, when you ask us to pay more. And in that case, the ERS person did ask the Public, that could I make more? I make more.
They made more on donations according to that piece, apparently.
Right.
Yeah. And when they tour it in different countries.
But
too.
The argument, and see, this idea like just ask us, and then the theater not willing to budge in that case, in the case of Gats, because that would set a precedent, not only for their theater, but for their whole like group of theaters.
Mm-hmm.
There is a logic to that. There is an economic logic to that. These things only happen, it's not individual, every person for themselves. It's a block of union actors and then a block of theaters. And if one theater breaks ranks, on this stuff, then it sets a precedent. And I imagine, I'm not in the room, and her piece, to be fair, does not talk to actual people in the room, because none of them can talk on the record, neither Equity people nor the theaters. So we don't hear their side of it, but that's just the fact that it's ongoing. There are maybe different interests at these theaters, some who are just saying there's no way and others who are saying we must do more. And so the theaters themselves have to, not just negotiate with the actors, but negotiate among themselves over what they're going to, what the new standard will be.
Well, then, I mean, there has to be an industry standard, and then it's up to each theater to, and if they can pay more than the minimum, it's great to pay to do that. We're working on a story right now about like theaters around the country who do pay above the minimum just because, they happen to like get a grant for it or they get an endowment fund. So it's possible. I think the issue is like when you're negotiating in one large group versus another large group.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the off-Broadway sector, when the smaller producers are grouped, lumped together in negotiations with the quote unquote big six theater, mm-hmm. Atlantic, the Public, and not everyone can afford like, a 500K theater cannot afford to pay the actor the same as a $43 million theater. So there seems to be something wrong with lumping all of those institutions together in one big contract.
This is one thing that her story brings up, but everyone seems to be puzzled about, is that the smaller theaters have joined in with this, with the big six. I'm not sure why that is, and what the thinking behind that is. I mean, when I first heard that, I thought that's not a good sign. That means that the small theaters and the big theaters must all be trying to say, look, we are all poor and we all need to, but
they're not all poor.
This is all speculation.
Well,
I'm
the
not
big
sure.
six are all different sizes too.
They
and
are.
Actors usually make more money at Lort theaters, like across the country than they do at theaters in New York.
Yeah.
And aren't theaters like the Public and Signature Lort?
No, they're not.
No.
They're not?
No,
all outside of New York?
The only Lort theaters are the one with Broadway houses, the Roundabout, Lincoln Center, Manhattan Theater Club.
Okay, so those ones have the Lort contract, not the off-Broadway contract.
Right, so what we're talking about is that...
No, I know the off-Broadway
contract. No, but I mean, it sounds to me that that's a reason that they probably make more at a nonprofit Broadway company than you do at the off-Broadway.
But then when you're
at Seattle Rep or Denver Center,
you're on Broadway with something like Roundabout, your Broadway fee is lower because you
a little bit, but apparently not that much, right?
Mm.
I don't know. We don't have the numbers. I know that the Roundabout doesn't pay as much as, say, a commercial producer is required to pay, and of course there's some commercial off Broadway producers who are wondering, can they also get a separate deal? They're not part of this negotiation, I don't believe, are they?
I thought they were. I read in the Wall Street Journal article, they are part of the same negotiations.
All right. Helen's piece focuses...
commercial off-Broadway ones?
Okay.
Yeah. Though I believe, to your point, Susie, if you're both Lort and off-Broadway, I believe the Lort contract supersedes it because it's a higher rate. But I could be wrong.
I don't. But I think that's the point. Is that Lourdes is regional theaters and Broadway nonprofits, and then Off Broadway is a different thing.
And Off Broadway is less than Lourdes.
Yes.
Yes.
That's surprising to me.
Yeah, I know. It's messed up, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you look at what the budget sizes are. I mean, is the public is certainly huge, as huge as maybe the Taper.
Exactly. But the Taper pays more.
Because the Taper's lower and the public's off Broadway.
Yeah. No, because I was just comparing it to, you know, like the Wilma, which is a Lord D, which is not 600 some odd a week, but versus they pay the same rate as the public, even though the Wilma has a significantly smaller budget size, like 3 million versus 43 million for the public. And so there seems to be a disparity here that should really be addressed.
Different tiers.
Because even seating in New York City, it's always going to be small. You cannot get away from having a small theater. Like, you can't have a 1,000-seat theater in New York City. So...
There are some.
Well, they're all the Broadway houses.
But you're saying off-Broadway you can't.
So it feels like it's somehow gaming the system so that you can get away with paying people less because you have a small house. But that the small house is unavoidable. So...
Well, that might be where volume comes in. Like, if you have a small house, then you really can't make that much ticket revenue, right? I mean, a lot of this comes down to as the similar things we've talked about, that nonprofits are businesses, but they are businesses in which every budget line is contingent upon mission. And so if you're not doing it for profit, in other words, you're doing it, our mission is to get this in front of as many people as possible. And if your mission is to lower ticket prices, as Jim Houghton's was at the Signature, that's where your money's going to go. If your mission is to have a beautiful building so that patrons really have a good experience, that's a budget line. That's important. If your mission is to sustain artists so that they, you know, can stay in the town where you are, this applies not just to New York, but everywhere, then that's reflected in your mission. It's all, there is a certain amount of the revenue, which is income from seats. And other revenue, but a lot of it is donated, and it's all mission driven. So again, as a broken record on this, that artist compensation has been a part of the Lourdes and resident theater movement. It's been a priority for many people. It's not universally been a priority, and in the New York market, it's gotten so punishing. I do think there is a time for course correction, but the only way it happens is with collective action. I think in such a brutal marketplace, that's my take on it, at least.
Oh no, definitely. Which is so surprising to me then that Equity would be okay with like a $56 pay raise in between 2012 to 2016. I feel
it's a $200 pay raise for the month, right? Because it's $50 a week.
Yeah. But it's New York City.
Yeah. I know. Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't know. The union can play hardball. They can't play hardball in every negotiation. But this one is really grassroots activism on the outside. And it's, you know, just looking at those numbers, it does seem overdue. And looking at the numbers you can make outside New York, it does seem overdue. It is as with any adjustment that management is expected to make, whether it's the overtime or whether it's the 99 seat, it's a big course correction, and management is going to scream, not because they're bad people, but because that's how they've just always budgeted it. And now they're asked to add this, a larger budget line in this area that they haven't. And there's obviously a moral case for it.
But I feel like, to your point about mission too, I feel like you don't have to have it in your mission to like sustain artists and pay them well, to like sustain artists and pay them well, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah, that should be the minimum.
Like, your mission can be to like, give great art to the city of New York, but in order to do that, you need to pay artists well, right?
Well, you could definitely argue that it shouldn't even be a question, and that it should be legal, like it should be a legal rubric that people shouldn't be paid under. But I do feel like there's also, just one could argue, I'm just that your mission is to give as much access to your stage to artists, and so your mission could be not about artists as professionals entirely. Like, it could be a professional amateur mix. It could be, I mean, these are all sound like, you know, ways that people get around paying artists. But I feel like a lot of times, especially artists who want to do self-producing, like in a showcase code, this is the 99 seat argument. Like, we are all actors ourselves. We would rather express ourselves than be paid. But the problem is, of course, you know, there's a collective action problem that if everyone wants to do that, then no one's going to get paid. And producers will find a way to go, you know, those people are getting paid. So, you know.
I mean, that's what happened with the touring, the Broadway touring contract. That's why they created a non-professional Broadway touring contract.
And that's a huge another issue because there's like two companies of each show's, one's equity, one's non-equity.
Exactly.
It's the exact same show, and the non-equity are getting paid so much less even though they're doing the exact same work.
Yeah, the trend line there is that the equity tour goes out and then a non-equity tour is created. I don't think that happens with every show, but I know Mamma Mia, a lot of other shows.
Yeah, I know around the holidays like Elf and I think Christmas Story do it.
They have non-union tours as well?
I think so. I don't know if they have union tours. It might just be non-union, but I'm not sure.
I mean, granted for that, I understand the impetus of, you know, non-union actors should be able to get these roles, but at the same time, like, those rates aren't comparable. So it seemed like from a producing end, it just seems like a way to get out of paying people more, which I guess is my bias. I am on the advocacy end of paying people more just because, especially like we were talking last episode about high ticket prices to off-Broadway shows, and something like Plenty starring Rachel Weisz starts at $95. And so you think, okay, so we want to increase access, but access for whom? Because at $95, who can access that? And so therefore, where is that money going to?
Well, those are different discussions. Access is one thing. I think the real scandal that people feel there is that when that's the starting ticket price, but what are actors making?
Yeah,
exactly.
Right, you know,
but they're still making 500. Besides,
well, we don't know what that cast is making.
Might have been making the same.
That's in the is that the theater that they only make 593 in?
Yeah, that was
the same theater that Hamilton was in.
Yeah,
yep.
I don't think the Hamilton cast is making 593 a week. Right? Who knows? Maybe they were.
They might have been.
All right. Well,
I don't know for sure, but I have an inkling.
Well, yeah, this is,
you know, people.
I do know people.
All right.
In the cast.
Of course, we know that they're all filthy rich now. But
yeah, they're doing just fine.
They're doing fine. Well, it's possible that this will be resolved by Sunday and we'll all have something good to report. I will say that I hear murmurs that things might, that they, you know, it might not reach the 810 goal, but that I think this, the off-Broadway theaters are going to step up a bit. That's the murmurs I hear. I don't know. I can't say for sure.
I'm crossing fingers for everybody. Actors.
All right. So our next topic is the election. We might seem a little bit out of it, I guess. I'm trying to put a bright face on it, but it's been a hard week.
As you can see, our productivity has not been the best.
Well, our web traffic has also not been the best.
Exactly. So I feel like there's a sense right now of just wanting to talk about politics, which is what I'm personally wanting to do and what most theater people I know wants to do. And so it seems not frivolous, but,
well, I feel like everyone is dealing with the election in different ways.
We're a little distracted. That's for sure. Last night's gala, which was planned obviously well before the election, we gave the award to Danai Gurira, playwright, actor, who deep interviewed and was on our cover in February, one of our best covers ever, and a wonderful story as well. She gave a wonderful speech about how she had intended to be a lawyer, didn't intend to be an artist at all, but that she realized what art could do for underrepresented voices on the stage and also people in the audience and the way that it could engage audiences and tell stories, you know, and she felt newly, she was pretty down actually at first, but she was in conversation with friends, longtime friends who buoyed her spirits up and told her that it's very clear, at least we have clarity of what we need to do now, that it's time to meet this moment and fight. And, you know, she thought about Clifford Odets in the Depression, she cited, John Connie and Winton in Shoshona. In South Africa, those are artists whose work we look to, and Atha Fugard along with them, we look to in harsh times, and we look to them as inspirations. How will we be judged by how we respond to this moment? So that's a call she set out to the field, I think, not just to our individual artists. I don't know what else we think theater can do.
I don't know. I just think, I know the day after the election, I'm on Jason Robert Brown's mailing list, and he wrote a new song right after it happened and just sent it to everyone. And it was like a small gesture of like, and it was just like, he wrote a song. He like probably recorded it on his voice memos on his phone and just sent it around. And, you know, it was encouraging. It was a way to like use the arts, use his talent to like speak to the community in this time. I thought it was a nice thing to do.
What was the song about?
It was called Hope.
Oh, what are we hoping for?
Just searching for it.
Searching for it. Yeah.
I've been thinking about this for the past few days, but I haven't figured out how to put it down writing. But Danai said most of it, which was the importance of putting underrepresented voices on stage, because yeah. I was thinking all the EDI work that we do, like it's all about increasing empathy and not just giving opportunity, but letting people see voices, different voices on stage that they may have never encountered, and seeing bodies that they have never encountered. And I think like one of the big key things I've heard about this election result was like a good amount of America voted this way for this person, and they saw that, you know, they didn't like the racist, xenophobic, you know, misogynist values, they weren't a deal breaker because those people have never encountered people whose Trump's policies, they've never encountered people that his policies would affect. Like, right. You know, Muslims, immigrants, Mexicans.
Or if they don't take them seriously or see them as the other.
Yeah. Right. And so I feel like for theater artists, just the important, if you're a theater in middle America, I feel like it's probably your job to put those bodies on stage now, because that's probably going to be the only time your audience sees that kind of body. And so, like, you know, stories like Not Disgrace, because that may be not a good idea to put that up right now. But, you know, maybe plays by Jose Rivera or plays by Karen Zacharias.
It's interesting. I think, yeah, she mentions that we need to tell stories that risk consequences, that might have consequences. And I would say Disgrace is one that might not play into the best angels of our nature, but we should be, I feel like we as companies and organizations should create places where it's safe for those conversations to happen, but the conversations themselves should be thorny and dramatic. And I remember after 9/11, to which this moment has been compared to, at least in some way some people are feeling.
Also, I didn't realize it was 11/9.
Right.
Was election day.
Oh, Jesus.
people comparing it to that. And I remember distinctly because I was editing theater. I was a theater editor at Backstage West at the time. And everything, of course, everything seemed to have new weight. Everything, every heavy thing, you know, I was all susceptible to crying. But I remember distinctly, there were two kinds of reviews I would get. One for escapism, where people would say, this is exactly what we need right now to take our mind off it. And then the other one for hard-hitting, confrontational stuff. Like, this is exactly what we need. It's like, actually, you know, we need both. We need exactly what we need, I think, is to gather in rooms together think the thoughts that plays allow us to, and also feel the feelings together collectively. And that's not just with the people in the audience, but the people on stage. I think that exchange, that communion feels more important than ever to me.
But then we also have a lot of member theaters in red states and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what they'll be doing in the wake of this election. I mean, we don't know yet. It's only been a few days.
Well, I think that's what you're talking about, Deep, is that I think their mission has to be to address their audiences.
And just humanize people that their audiences may have never met.
Right.
And I was talking to Janet Allen at Indiana Repertory Theater. And right now they're doing a play about, you know, the history of Indiana. And they're not shying away from the fact that Indiana has a history with the KKK. But that state also has like African-American heroes and Native mm-hmm. American heroes, and just putting those kind of stories on stage.
I mean, it's in the name of the state, right?
Yeah.
It's history right there. I think we will do more reporting. We're going to reach out to a lot of artists around the country and theater folks to find out what they plan to do to respond to this moment. It does feel like an urgent moment. Apart from all the organizing that people want to do, the protesting, the letter writing that people want to do, I think theaters you know, can be places. I mean, I will just say, the little church I go to in Greenpoint, I feel like is going to be a hub of organizing. It's not just there for comfort, which is definitely that, but it's also there as a place to bring people together. And I think theater is a place to bring people together. I mean, there was the story we wrote about the theaters registering people to vote in the lobbies. Maybe if that had been in some other states, it might have been, been a good thing. But, yeah, there's another a good piece, Anthony Burns. I don't know if you saw that piece that we shared. He's a director out in LA, and he wrote a piece before the election and after the election about making the link, which other people have made, that democracy and theater started in the same, you know, as we know it in the West, started in the same place in Greece. And who was it who was saying that?
Kevin Moriarty of Dallas Theater Center was saying how before Grecians were allowed to vote, they had to watch some plays.
They had to watch like two tragedies and a comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it was like required viewing. It's like, imagine if you had to register to vote here, you had to go see a tragedy. And, you know, of course, it was theater, music, religion, and civic life were all kind of one thing for the Greeks, right? So, we've pulled them all apart, and we all have our own channels we can watch. But I think the point of having more civic engagement and community engagement seems, again, more important than ever. I mean, Danai also said, put down your smart devices and let's get back to storytelling basics, you know?
Right. Well, and I read a quote from, I think it was an article in Vice that said the suffragettes didn't get women the voting rights by walking down the street wearing headphones reading Twitter.
No, they didn't. Of course, we're sharing these stories on our devices and reading our admonitions to get off of our devices from our devices. But we, you know.
But no.
As you listen to this on your device, just just know that when it's over, turn it off and do something.
Put it away.
Talk to somebody.
Talk to an actual person, see an actual person perform something, and pay them for it.
Yeah.
So bringing all our themes together. we'll talk about it more. It's not going away. There's a lot ahead of us. We will talk now to Sarah Delap.
So I'm sitting down with playwright Sarah Delap, a writer of The Wolves that's going to be writing at the Duke from November 29th to December 24th. Welcome. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Deb.
So first, how did the re-engagement happen?
I'm a little stumped myself. The play closed at the end of September, and I was really interested in it having a second life. I think a lot of other people were as well. And luckily, Scott Rudin got involved, and provided, he and Eli Bush are providing some funding for the production, and it's happening again with the Playwrights Realm. So it all just came together in a very fortuitous fashion.
Did you know that he had seen the play and was interested in it, or was it a surprise for you?
It was somewhat of a surprise. I knew that once he saw it, I knew that he liked it, but it all just happened rather quickly.
And it's so interesting because it's like you and Annie Baker, they're seeing, and also, you know, Steve Karam, he seems to be really interested right now in young writers who are tackling issues or themes that are relevant to America right now.
Yeah, which is very, again, it's very generous of him, I think, to be doing that and to be invested and involved in theater and new types of theater and new kinds of stories. It's definitely an incredibly exciting thing that's happening.
Yeah. It's your first play, too.
Yeah, it's my first production. I know. I know.
How are you going to top this one?
I never will. I'm quitting.
So we were talking, let's just talk about the elephant in the room. We were supposed to talk last Wednesday.
Yes.
Post-election.
The day after the election.
And we thought, Yeah. Well, when we schedule this, everyone says Hillary was going to win, and so you're not too worried yeah. about talking post the election. And the day after, I think, like, I emailed you, and I was just thinking, I don't know if I can do this today.
Yeah, yeah, yes. And I felt like I can't talk about art. I can't talk about plays. What's the point in this terrible, terrible time? And now I feel like such an asshole because I remember the day of the election. I remember the day of the election having a conversation with someone and asking and talking about what we would do if Hillary won and if there would be a celebration in the streets or if it would just be like a sigh of relief. And now that feels like so much a part of the problem and how we ended up here.
And how so?
Just in the like complacency. And I feel like the complacency 8 years of an Obama administration allowed some people who weren't political when they should have been.
Right. I think that there's so much surprise on for a certain subset of my Facebook friends of like, I had no idea America was this racist and this bigoted and this sexist. And then there's some of us who are also thinking, wait, where have you been?
Yeah.
And, well, you're talking about, like, not being sure of what art can do or just the value of talking about it. So have you come around in that line of thinking or?
No, not at all. Not at all. I still feel like, I mean, it's terrible. We have elected a racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic monster to head our country. And the things he could do in the next 4 years are terrifying. And really mysterious also in a way because he hasn't been so clear about, you know, any like concrete policy matters. So I do feel like at a crossroads. We're all at a crossroads and it's a very scary crossroads and the devil is right there.
Well, what do you think? Because I've been talking to so many artists about it and everyone I think feels this sense of, well, this is just art. Like, what can we do besides, like, going out in the street and marching, which, you know, many artists I know did that this weekend. But is there a value in just, like, doing something like the Wolves and putting young women on stage and making audiences realize that young women are also humans?
Yeah. Right. Yes. That's a surprising fact. Yeah, I mean, I think there is. I don't want to overstate it too much, but I do believe in the value of art, and I do believe that telling stories in this certain time and at all times do actually have a trickle-down effect into people's perceptions and how they think of, like with my play, young women, teenage girls. And that is valuable, and I do think that serves – I feel like I have to believe in that in order to keep doing what I'm doing.
What do you think you're right about next?
Great question. I don't know. I'm figuring it out. I'm working on a couple of different projects, but it probably will not be about teenage girls.
Yeah. So speaking of the Wolves, can you, because I read the New York Times piece about you and how you were inspired to become a playwright, which was Paula Vogel. And, you know, because of Paula Vogel, I feel like she's launched 1,000 fierce female playwrights. And because you wanted to be an actress.
Sure. I wanted to be an actress. I took a class. It was like a community class in a basement. And it was a lot of like retirees and people from the community. And it totally just, I don't think up until that point I had thought you could be a playwright. I didn't think that you could be alive, really, and be like a functioning human being and be a playwright. It just had never occurred to me.
Where did plays come from?
That's a great question. Or maybe I should rephrase that. I didn't think I could be a playwright. And something about Paula Vogel and her magic and how she thinks about theater really changed. I guess it just changed everything for me. And it changed how I thought about telling stories in time and space and like what the possibilities were of theater. And it made me that I just like had a moment where I was like, this is it for me. This is what I want to do.
And, well, I mean, playwrights don't get paid, so...
Right.
Like, Well, what's a better, you know, low-paying job for you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I didn't really understand that part of it at the time.
So what did she tell you that made you want to do this for a living?
I think what it was is I – really what it was – and this is just like what an incredible teacher she is I brought in a bake-off. She has people do bake-offs. And mm-hmm. I brought in a bake-off. And I grew up in Nevada. And I wrote a play set at the Utah test sites in the 50s while they were doing all of these atomic testing mm-hmm. in the desert. And it was about a Mormon family living downwind. And there were these twins, and one of them was developing leukemia and the other one wasn't, and it was all, you know, going through time, and there was like an underground shelter, and I brought it in, and I just remember after hearing it, and I had worked so hard on it and felt like I invested so much in it, and I feel like she was like, this is great, you could be a playwright. And no one had ever said that to me about anything, really. So it was really, I guess it was just like a moment of confidence, which is what teachers can do for young, lost people.
Right. Well, in that New York Times article they ran about you, there was a quote where you said, I had too many roles where I was wearing a crown of flowers and playing an innocent virgin. And then, 'cause I'm thinking like that empowerment that you're talking about, mm-hmm. because there's so much more power in being a playwright versus being a female actor, mm-hmm. because there's so, like, your roles tend to be in two different types. You're either an ingenue or you get old enough and you turn into a mom. You can't play those young roles anymore.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I did find that to be really frustrating, always being the virgin with the crown of flowers and the white dress. And it just isn't true. It makes you feel powerless. And the life of an actor also feels powerless, and that as a woman, you have to put yourself out there for those roles and package yourself and objectify yourself. And you do have so much more power as a playwright to tell different stories for those very same actors.
Right. Well, it was so interesting to me when I saw The Wolves, and all the press that came out about it was like these 10 young female actors occupying the stage. Uh-huh. And you're just thinking, wait, why is this? I mean, I know it's a big deal, but like we're in 2016 and Hillary Clinton is running for president. Uh-huh. And yet we don't have very many works in the American canon about women and mm-hmm. that are just about women talking to each other.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it shouldn't be that big of a deal. And yet it is. It really is. And something also I think about teenagers, about young women who are roundly, I feel like culturally they're either objectified or they're vilified. And they're hated and they're annoying. And the way they talk and the up speak and the
vocal fry.
The vocal fry, which I actually find to be really beautiful. I feel like they're at the forefront of speech in a way. And we're all now picking up traits that were once associated with teenage girls in, say, the Valley. And I think there's a lot of music to the way teenage girls speak. And they're just so... they're at the prime of their lives. They're so malleable and they're figuring out who they are and adopting certain roles or archetypes and trying to fit into the group and then breaking out from that and coming back in. And yeah, I think there's something about that that is really, I hope, compelling to watch these young people find themselves.
Right. Well, that was what I noticed when I first watched it because, like, I mean, I grew up with Tina Fey's movie Mean Girls. Yeah. And that was, like, always a touchstone of the teenage girl experience for me. But at the same time, that movie is also very limiting because it depicts teenage girls as either sex. Mm-hmm. I mean, it in popular culture in general depicts teenage girls as either sex objects or as mean girls, mm-hmm. as catty girls. And there is no nuance in that. And I feel like young teenage men, like they're allowed to have nuance. They're allowed to be Huckleberry Finn and go out on adventures, or they're mm-hmm. allowed to be Holden Caulfield and just hate the world. But teenage girls aren't afforded that kind of depth.
Yes, there's just a narrower spectrum of things available to teenage girls, I think, culturally, which is why I also, when I was writing The Wolves, I was thinking about it a lot as a war movie. Like, this is a band of sisters, and they're going to battle, but their battles are their soccer games, and each of them has a different role. And we watch them, it's all about their community and their relationships to each other, mm-hmm. which I also think is true of girls and of growing up. You do forge your identity through your community.
Were there any particular teenage experiences of yours that made it into the play? Because you played soccer, too.
Yeah, I did play soccer. I actually didn't play soccer at the level of these girls. The Wolves are, like, a pretty great team to be playing club and indoor. And I quit long before that. But I don't know. I don't think there are any purely autobiographical moments in the play. I think all of the characters are sort of an... like both, I guess, a love letter to and an amalgamation of all of the teenage girls that I've known and loved and hated and, you know, admired. My sister's definitely in there. I have a twin sister.
Oh, I didn't know that. They did not write that in a Times article.
I know. I know. yeah, I do think the play is kind of, if I'm going to do a little pop psychology, is about twins in a way, about like looking, they're all in uniform, they all have that uniform together, and yet they're finding their own separate identities.
All right. Well, wait, what does your sister do?
She's applying to med school.
Oh, wow, that is the opposite.
Yeah,
okay.
Truly. Yep, could not be more different.
I love what you said about archetypes, because I did notice that. Too, of like teenage girls have a very particular way of relating to each other, because I feel like there's like a little bit of the meanness, but it's not meanness out of cattiness or out of viciousness. It's like the meanness of boys.
Yes,
like you're just truthful and you don't mean to hurt your feelings, but
yeah. Yeah, I think that's so great. They're just being rough with each other, like boys. If boys do the exact same thing and we don't blink an eye, it's the same boys being boys. We should let girls be boys.
Or let girls.
I don't know if I stand by that, but you know.
Well,
let
girls play soccer.
Yeah, exactly. And let us see them as athletes and really tough and smart and ignorant and trying to figure things out.
What? And so why did you stop playing soccer?
I stopped playing soccer because I went to a high school. My sister and I got scholarships to this, like, private school, and they didn't have a soccer team. And I was devastated at the time. I was like, this is ruining my high school career. Yeah.
Yes, you could have gone to the women's league, but your career is cut short.
Like, how will I be, like, bend it like Beckham? Yeah.
And so, well, you're talking about, like, your next play is not being about teenage girls, but do you think, like, it's still going to be that very female-centric? There's such a lack of it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hope so. I mean, I don't want to pigeonhole myself, and I don't think I'm going to just keep writing, like, The Wolves 10 years later, The Wolves 20 years later. But I do, I mean, I am a woman, and I am interested in women's stories, and I do, yeah, I imagine that I'll keep writing a lot of roles for women.
Right. I just love what you said about the Bechdel test and how it should be the bare minimum of what we expect from any work, but it's still a marker that, an unreachable marker.
Yes, but it should be so... It shouldn't be something that we even have a marker for. It should just happen naturally. If you think about women and what women talk about and treat them with dignity and respect.
Yeah. When did you start writing it?
I started writing it 2014, the summer of 2014.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What? So I have to ask, like, how do you have your first play be produced? By Scott Rudin.
I don't know.
Can you replicate that?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, this play, I truly just wrote it. I was just writing it for myself. I wrote it in my bedroom over a couple of weeks. And then just like did some readings with some friends and then brought it into my Club Thumb early career writers group. And then we did a workshop and it just kind of snowballed from there. But I don't, beats me.
But did you go to an MFA program though?
I'm going to an MFA. I'm at Brooklyn College right now.
Because that's like, no, it's like, you have no idea. It's like blowing my mind because like you, because I feel like there's this rule of, okay, if you want to be a real playwright, you have to go to undergrad and afterwards you have to go get your MFA and then get to know all of these people who have produced your work. But you defied that almost.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that it's false to say that there are certain rules for being a playwright. I feel like a lot of people don't get MFAs. And there are a bunch of people at Brooklyn College who, like, have had productions or are having productions. It's an amazing, amazing group of playwrights out there. And maybe that's just part of, like, being in New York and getting your MFA on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. No, but it's limiting to think you have to go through the university system. So it's really refreshing when I meet playwrights or actors or artists who haven't done that. And so because I feel like unlike August Wilson, who never went to an MFA program, he just wrote like that. It seems like there's a normalization of academia that I feel is very dangerous.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that it just, it's just continuing the institutions that already exist and like keeping that institutional chain of power.
Right. Instead of going out into the world and
finding new voices.
And, experiencing and then writing about it.
Yes, right. Yeah, which is really what it's all about.
So can you tell us about, do you have any workshops coming up, any readings? Possible production?
No, not right now. I am working on a one act with Club Thumb is doing this emerging directors program. Mm-hmm. That's really amazing because there is so little support for emerging directors. So I'm writing a one act and Ellie Williams is directing it and he's amazing. And that will be happening sometime in January.
What's the one act about?
It's about a figure drawing class in Reno, Nevada, and there's a naked male model and three women amateur artists drawing him and a female instructor.
What's it called?
It's called Richard in Nine Poses.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I used to do figure drawing class.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Amazing.
It was one of my favorite. I mean, not because you get to see naked people, but just...
Well, it
helps. Yeah, it helps so much to just see someone there.
Yeah,
and then having to like really focus on the contours of their body. It was one of the most relaxing things that you can ever do.
Yeah, I feel like it slows down your looking, and it makes you see in a different way, which I think is interesting to put that on stage and to watch all these people looking and overhearing each other. It's kind of it could so easily. Slip into a paranoid space because of the nudity and because of the looking and
no, but then you get used to it after a while.
Yeah, totally. It normalizes like anything.
Yep. Well, just normalize things by putting them on stage. That's great.
Totally. Trump. So scary. It's too soon.
Yes, maybe too soon to actually put him on stage.
Unless we're going to throw things at him.
Maybe. I think that might be therapeutic.
Darts. Yeah.
Yeah, like an audience participatory. Yeah. Think about it.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.
And we are back with a few recommendations of things to see, think about, read. Susie, what you got?
I'm going to recommend Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 on Broadway. I saw it when it was at Ars Nova, and I saw it when it was had the big tent in the Meatpacking District. And I was not a huge fan of it at either place. I mean, I really liked the music. I liked the actors. Deep is shaking her head, but this is my recommendation time. It just wasn't my cup of tea. I was just totally won over by it on Broadway. I thought Josh Groban was amazing. I thought Danae Benton was also incredible, who plays Natasha. There's a new song. There might be more than one new song. There's definitely one new song for Josh Groban that's amazing. The way they've converted the theater is incredible. Like what Rachel Chavkin and Mimi Leanne have done with that space. You wouldn't even know it was like a proscenium space. And I don't know. It feels like Dave Malloy has like edited it a little bit. It's still the same score, but it somehow is smoother and was easier for me to understand. And I don't know. It was just a completely spellbinding, captivating experience. Sit on the stage if you can. It's amazing.
Isherwood says it's like it's better than Hamilton.
That's Isherwood. I'm not saying it's better than Hamilton, but it's incredible and you should see it.
Great. Well, Dave Malloy, friend of the magazine, the podcast, and his wife Eliza used to work with us. But
Dave Malloy connection. That's not why I'm recommending it.
No, of course not.
It's just a wonderful show. Go see it.
And you can also listen not to the Broadway cast album, but the off Broadway version where Dave played the title character Pierre on Spotify. It's pretty great. Most like Hamilton, it's sung through, so most of the songs.
I hate to break it to Dave, but Josh can sing better than he can.
Of course,
I don't think Dave would argue with that.
I don't think. Yeah,
and
think
hearing those Pierre songs and Josh's voice, changes the show.
I don't know. Like I've always affiliated it with Dave in my head because I've been with it for so long. So to hear him sing it, so to hear Josh Groban sing it, I'm just like, oh. See, he sounds so pretty and nice.
What about that new song? Like, What If I Die? That was so good.
Oh, Pierre just wants love.
Well, I'll have to break the tie and see it myself. Dee, what do you have to recommend today?
Yeah. So last week was really rough, guys, because I started out the week going to the every 28-hour play project about police brutality. And then I ended the week by going to the After Orlando play reading about the Pulse Massacre, and I moderated a panel after. So, you know, I haven't been I'm not feeling the most positive right now.
Right.
But I will say, If either of those come into your town, and they are, you should go see it because I really think it's like it's not healing because healing would be too big of a word, but I think it's a really cathartic experience to be in the room, see some really socially, you know, socially relevant and provoking art, and then stay afterwards to talk to other people about these issues that continue to affect our community, you know, issues of police brutality and homophobia and LGBT rights and, you know, Islamophobia, and just these issues aren't going to go away. And I think like those two initiatives are really valuable right now. And if you can go to a theater and talk to other people about it, it's going to be really helpful, I think. So do that. We run articles about both projects in American Theater. So go read those articles. Go
and
see those shows.
They're both projects of short plays in response to, again, police brutality and then the case of the issues raised by the Orlando massacre.
Yeah. 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 And great playwrights. Lindsay Ferrantino, the monologue she writes about Orlando is just breathtaking, and so many plays. David Henry Hwang wrote a play for Every 28 Hours Project. Just like playwrights from around the country coming together to write about things that matter to us right now. So, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we recommend going to there'll be websites listed on this.
The
show page, so you can find out where these events are happening, because there are a lot of different theaters are doing it around the country. Well, I would just recommend, the day after the election, I saw the first performance, I saw the matinee. So it was a Wednesday, the first performance after the election of Falsettos, which I saw when it initially came out. And it's a strange, beautiful, but kind of amazing show. There's no other show like it. There's no, like, a uniquely sobering and yet sort of like nervy and bubbly musical about really heavy stuff. It reminded me a little bit. I had made the connection before. It was like almost like a spiritual sequel to Company in a way. And it has that sort of, milieu and feel to it as if Bobby had gone on and then screwed up some relationships after that. But it also has a sort of overlay of angels in America because it's not just because it has an AIDS character, but because it was written in two parts. And the two parts sort of hang together. They were written many years apart, and they follow the same sort of characters, and they're sort of a family, a non-traditional family that forms around them. But the big moment, I highly recommend it. It's there's some casting issues with it, but it's wonderful. And it's great to see it with an audience. But I'd forgotten about Trina's song.
It's the best part of the whole show.
When she comes out, I'm sure this had resonance even before.
Oh, yeah, it was incredible.
But I don't know if this happened at the performance you saw, which was, this is right after not just the election of Donald Trump, but the demise of Hillary Clinton. Stephanie Block comes out and sings the line, "I'm tired, so tired of all the happy men who rule the world. Silly, silly, childish jerks." It goes on like that.
And the song's called "I'm Breaking Down," too.
That's not this. No, the other song is "I'm Breaking Down." This is just called Trina's song.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought
her, she's got that big hilarious number where she's breaking down.
Oh, I thought that line was in "I'm Breaking Down."
No, this is more of a sort of ballad. And, you know, the problematic thing about that song is that she says all that and she says, but, you know, I love them. And, you know, so she goes, she's going back to those men. But it's just amazing. And she teared up. The audience had to break for applause a few times in that song. That I'm not sure that that was...
No, it didn't part happen of the when I saw it.
It was a pretty visceral experience. And just the show's focus on what it means to be a man and guys screwing up that effort and trying to raise a son in a better way resonated with me very strongly, not least because the boy playing Jason looks quite a bit like my eldest son. And I'm going to not say more, or I might tear up. So on that wonderful...
This has been the most depressing episode of Off Script ever.
On that note of vulnerability, I will recommend that you look at our show page, go to iTunes and rank us. I'm so bad at this end of the show stuff, Dave. Tell me what else we should say.
Leave a comment. It helps people find us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, leave a review. I'm sorry, guys. I'm out of it, too. Sorry.
Well, links to all the things we've talked about will be on the show page.
Yeah. Find us on iTunes. Tell people about us.
Talk to us on Twitter.
Yeah. And see you next time.
All right. Bye now.